Hello everyone, it's a pleasure to do this lecture, although I'm new to the whole Zoom experience. And as right and proper, I'll kick off the discussion about the Western Balkans and external powers with a small vignette about COVID-19. This is the world we live in these days. So on 15th of March, Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić held a televised press conference where he announced the introduction of state emergency. As in many other countries, Serbia followed down that route. But what was interesting and what grabbed headlines across Europe and beyond was the harsh words he had to say about the European Union. He famously or infamously referred to European solidarity as a fairy tale. And then he went on to castigate unnamed European officials for preventing Serbia to import essential medical equipment. And he actually said that those were the same people who for months and years were telling us never buy stuff from the Chinese, don't cooperate with Beijing, but now our money here, which is said, is no good for the European products. So there was China, a friend of Serbia in need, and there was cold-hearted Europe. And this metaphor captured some of the kind of attitudes in the region. A week or so later, Vučić was seen on Belgrade Airport welcoming an Airbus, incidentally a European-made jet, delivering supplies to Serbia. He even kissed the flag and thanked Brother Xi. Billboards carrying the image of the Chinese leader and also writing in Serbian in Cyrillic, thank you, Brother Xi, appeared across the Serbian capital, which again was circulated widely in the Western media. And of course, it was not too late, too much later, that Russia jumped on the bandwagon. There was a delivery over 2 days in early April of medical supplies, but also teams of medics and virologists affiliated with the Russian Ministry of Defense arriving to Batajnica Air Base, which is incidentally again a site where the Serbian and the Russian military have been conducting drills for the past 6 years, I believe. And it's not only Russia, certainly Turkey joined in. Again, around the first week of April, Turkey delivered supplies to all six Western Balkan countries. Turkey used the NATO multilateral mechanism. So having already sent those supplies to Spain and Italy, Turkey also prioritized the Western Balkans, as well as North Africa and interesting Israel, but the Western Balkans was in Turkey's kind of focus. So that's what's interesting, essentially, that the Western Balkans over the past couple of years have become this topic of very robust conversation, which revolves around the question, is the region abandoning the West? Is the game we've known for at least two decades, certainly since the late 90s, no longer valid? In other words, that NATO and the EU and the Western anchor is the only game in town, and we are going towards a scenario where this is a contested region with various external powers, including Russia, Turkey, and China, but also probably other players like the Gulf monarchies, vying for influence, trying to project political but also economic their clout in the region. Now, before I kind of put forward my thoughts on this subject, and in the spirit of shameless self-promotion, I wrote a book about Russia in Southeast Europe called Rival Power. Let's acknowledge the other viewpoint. There'll be a bunch of people saying, what's the big deal? Of course, you have a lot of opportunistic powers moving around the Balkans. But then again, if you look at the big picture, the EU accounts for 2/3 of the economic activity of trade in the region, and the bulk of investment and other forms of financial inflows in the region is the EU. And also, at the end of the day, human connections bind the region, the Western Balkans, with the core of Europe. It's where Bosnians or Serbians or Kosovo Albanians seek employment. Also, they would send their children there, and so on and so forth. So the humanscape actually puts the region in Europe, and also geographically, you have the region surrounded by your territory. And the other argument, of course, is the institutional argument. Just before COVID kicked in, the big news in the region was, first of all, that North Macedonia joined NATO, which would be relevant to many folks listening to this lecture, but also that the EU ministers foreign affairs actually finally gave green light for the start of membership negotiations with, again, North Macedonia and Albania, a belated decision. So on the level of politics, economics, but also everyday life, you can make a strong argument that, after all, this is what the main game is. So, yeah, there's Russia, there's China, there's everybody else. But let's look at the long term and the big picture. Now, what I want to argue in this talk, as I've done in my writings over the past few years, certainly in the Russia book, is that there is a middle ground. We can acknowledge this sociological, but also economic reality of the Western embeddedness of the region, but as well give some credit to the changing dynamics and bringing those foreign powers. But my starting point really is that the fault of many analysts is that they look at the Western Balkans from a top-down perspective. What do I mean by that? Essentially, what matters is the supply. What big players are doing. Countries and the leaders in the region actually have agency. So much of what happens in regional politics is not driven necessarily from the push from outside, but also from the pull from the inside. So whether Serbia cooperates with China or looks towards the EU for assistance, as it did, is down to the strategy of choice of the Serbian leadership. And I say quote Serbia here because it's the par excellence example, but it equally applies to others as well. Again, Albania, a very pro-European country that now starts negotiations for membership. Its leader, President Edi Rama, showcases his special relationship to Recep Tayyip Erdogan, President of Turkey. The Bosnian leadership, certainly on the Bosniak side, is close to Turkey. And virtually everybody is interested in being part of China's economic initiative. So foreign influence is really often mediated by local agency and local leadership. So any useful discussion has to start from this premise that countries and individual actors in politics are moving this agenda forward. And sometimes it's the tail wagging the dog. They are instrumentalizing the foreigners for domestic political gain, for generating economic rent, for balancing against their competitors in the region, and so on and so forth. So there is this bottom-up dynamic, which I'll be coming back in my talk again and again. Now, my second point is that we have to look at the structure of incentives. If you sit in Belgrade, in Tirana, in Pristina Skopje, and so on and so forth, what is your perspective on the changing dynamics at the European level, but also probably global level? Now, certainly EU might be the only game in town. Again, the COVID crisis is an illustration. Yeah, there was Chinese aid. There was Russian aid and also Turkey sent supplies, but the EU has come up with policy over the long term, and now it's offering also aid for reconstruction, which will be increasingly important as we move to the next stage, depending on the depth of the recession. So you haven't lost interest in joining the EU, and certainly NATO is providing the security umbrella and protection. But there is a time dimension. None of those countries is joining the EU anytime soon. The most optimistic scenario suggests the end of this decade, certainly after the adoption of the next the expiry of the next financial framework in 2027. And even that is a very optimistic projection. Now, the kind of Europe they will be joining is likely to be much more decentralized, with much more denser type of integration at the core and a greater level of resource redistribution there. So even if they are becoming members, it will be a different beast altogether they'll be becoming part of. So, EU is on offer, and NATO is there, but you live in the short term, and in the short term, you can look elsewhere to maximize your political capital and to generate resources and so on and so forth. And it's, politicians are notoriously short-termistic in the West as well, not just on Europe's periphery. So that's one point. Long-term versus short-term. The other thing I want to say is that another background condition is the general deterioration of democratic governance and institutions. To start with, in the Western Balkans, the gains made in the past 20 years were not that impressive. So you don't see a country that has actually managed to consolidate a democratic regime. But now that the trend towards de-democratization is advancing across the world, you have serious decline in terms of rule of law, accountability, even competitiveness of the political systems elsewhere, which means that there is not that strong demand from below, from the grassroots, for leaders and political parties to advance this democratic agenda, which of course is part and parcel of the normative appeal of the West since the end of the Cold War. So it's a much more permissive environment, allowing individual leaders to actually pursue multi-vector policies abroad. There might not be a direct causal connection, but that's an environmental variable that plays there. We also have to bring in social learning. So if you are President Vucic or President Rama or Hashim Thaci of Kosovo, the moment somebody tells you, you shouldn't be working with the Chinese or just ignore Russia, and I'm oversimplifying here, it's not that the Kosovars will be looking anytime soon towards Russia or China, but Serbia is again a good example. But the moment you get this message from the West, you can turn around the table and say, but look, in Germany, you're also cooperating with China on 5G networks. You have an approach which is much more lenient towards Russia. Of course, you have the sanctions, but look, Emmanuel Macron is similarly arguing for partnership. So why should you single out Serbia for doing it, since you guys are doing much the same? So. And social learning also goes towards the other direction, that over two decades, those leaders, political elites, have learned how to not only turn Europeans' arguments on their heads, and Western arguments, but also talk the talk without walking the walk, just subscribing to any condition or any formal requirement without actually implementing it. Because again, they have a sufficient amount of local autonomy, and the time horizon is much, much ahead. So essentially, the weaker pull from the West, combined with the greater autonomy internally and the deterioration of the checks and balances and the democratic momentum domestically, is enabling these kind of strategies. A colleague of mine, Andrew Wilson, talking about Ukraine and Belarus, described this type of external behavior as neo-Titoism, I mean, of course, you're speaking about the post-Soviet world, but let me say that Titoism or Neo-Titoism is very popular in the lands that gave birth to Titoism originally. We shouldn't be surprised to see this type of behavior of hedging or balancing or looking to diversify relations abroad and looking beyond the West, not necessarily leaving the West or turning, making a choice, but subscribing to a policy course of having the cake and eat it. So very briefly, that's my point. Look what countries are doing, not only what external actors are doing. Now, having said that, what I want to do in the remaining 10 or 15 minutes is actually discuss the three main players before I conclude with some closing remarks. What Russia, Turkey, but also China are up to in the Western Balkans and probably a bit more broadly in Eastern Europe, the European periphery in general. Now, if you want to summarize Russia's policy in the region, you might remember a very apt phrase that Strop Talbot, the deputy foreign secretary in the US, coined with regard to Yevgeny Primakov in the 1990s. And I realize this is ancient history, but it's before Putin, but it's still relevant. So Strop Talbot, who is a Russianist, said that Russia's strategy is essentially playing a weak hand. Well, Russia doesn't have that much by way of resources, but it knows how to maximize its influence, even if it's a tactical player. Let's look at the evolution of Russia's policies since the 1990s. Back then, of course, it was involved in the Yugoslav wars, not least because the stakes were very high. It was not just the future of Yugoslavia and its successors, but also the European security order that was at stake, the place of NATO, EU, and so on and so forth. Russia had its troops in Bosnia and later in Kosovo. And despite the setback when it failed to prevent Western intervention in Kosovo, it had the ambition to be movers and shakers in the region. And actually, Putin was the person who, upon coming to the Kremlin, decided that those adventures, implications in the Balkans were kind of a difficult legacy from the Yeltsin, and he pulled out keepers from former Yugoslavia. So in his early years, Putin decided Russia returned in the mid-2000s because it saw Southeast Europe, the Western Balkans in particular, as an energy transit route to Europe. It was Russia not as a military power, but more as an energy player that was not necessarily a competitor against the West. It tried to build two players in Europe, including on the European. So that was the second stage of Russia's involvement. Now, the third stage started with Ukraine, where interpreted the crisis as the West encroaching on its turf, because it's a much more complicated story, and started to disrupt the West and Western influence anyway. Find an opportunity. And the West Balkans, to be honest, was and it still is bringing fruit because we have resentment against Western intervention in Serbia, in Republika, and a bunch of other places. And you can instrumentalize those sentiments. You can align yourself with local governments. And that's been the case since 2008 when Russia and Serbia's campaign to resist international recognition. But the point I want to make is that Russia doesn't have a long-term plan. It just tries to be there to maximize its geopolitical clout, identify local weak spots, and then try to leverage this influence vis-a-vis the West in this wider dynamic. And thinking in Russia is that you are meddling in our backyard, in Moldova, in Ukraine, Georgia, and elsewhere. we can do the same in your backyard. That's what is at play. And very often, and that's my last point about Russia, call deploys are disruptive. Alliances with fringe players, with nationalist forces, disinformation and fake news. And here, again, it's a complicated ways because Russia is spreading disinformation, but because local disinformation networks are using themes and stories generated by the Russians to amplify those domestically. So it's a two-way street. But really, the amount Russia really wields in the region to choices made by the locals. By starting point, Serbia aligned itself with the Russians in 2008 because of Kosovo. North Macedonia aligned itself in the previous government of Emiral Dapumare because it saw economic benefits and tried to emulate Serbian behavior. The Montenegrin opposition, or part of it, sought support from Russia. But then again, the country's ruler, President Djukanovic, who now parades as somebody who fights Russian influence, actually past reincarnation was one of the best friends of the Kremlin in the region because of the visit in. And again, going back to Serbia, which is the core ally, Serbia is using Russia, but doesn't mean that it doesn't cooperate with either the EU, where it seeks membership, but also with NATO. And it's down to the choices Vucic is making to use Russia whenever appropriate. And the Russians know that they're being kind of part of this dynamic, that Serbia is loyal as long as it's useful for its own elite. And this is the kind of cynical game that is going. And to be honest, Russia has suffered a number of setbacks. Tried to mobilize its proxies to stop NATO enlargement in Montenegro, but later in North Macedonia. It made some propaganda mileage out of it. Ultimately, it couldn't stop the process, and it cannot equally pose itself as an alternative to EU integration. Even I'd argue that in the long term, if Serbia, Bosnia, and so on join the EU and on a specified date, that might be good news for Russia because they'll have friendly, yet another friendly member state or two member states in Brussels. So that's my very short take on Russia. Now let's move to Turkey because we have to be economical with time. Now Turkey is often put in the same basket with Russia, and rightly so, because it has reinvented itself from ally of the West, a member of the Western club, to an autonomous power. But unfair in the sense that Russia is a speaking of external power, whereas Turkey's position is more complicated. It is also a Balkan country. Turkey indeed belongs to several regions because of its history and geography. It's part of the Caucasus as well as the Middle East, but it has a clear Balkan dimension. It's not a foreigner. Just to give a very practical example, when President Erdogan visited Serbia and went to Novi Pazar in the Muslim-populated Sanjak area, those people who were greeting him with Turkish flags typically have relatives living in big Turkish cities in the West. They visit Turkey, they have a very strong personal connection. Up to one third of Turkish population might have Balkan roots as well. And Turkey has been part of the same regional cooperation networks in the Balkans. And also, let's not forget, it's a member of NATO for what it's worth. So it is of the region, unlike Russia, and certainly unlike China, because of history, society, and geography. It has an ambiguous policy because sometimes it acts together with, and sometimes at cross purposes with the West, and sometimes in parallel to the West. It's certainly not a spoiler because I don't think Turkey has the objective of stopping EU and certainly not NATO's expansion. Indeed, it has supported Montenegro's accession and later on North Macedonia's accession. The ambitious policy it pursued 10 years ago under the Hutu Lewis foreign minister kind of showed its limits, because Turkey proved unable to replace the West as the mediator in Bosnia. And it has been excluded from the Kosovo normalization talks, or remains of it. The EU is the main player, with Russia on the sidelines, and now increasingly the US calling the shots. Turkey is not part of this dynamic. So, and also if you look at the economy, Turkey benefits from the fact that it's part of the EU customs union. That's of course the same framework that the Western Balkans are adhering to, thanks to the free trade agreements. Look at the wider Southeast Europe. Actually, the nations which trade the most with Turkey are not in the Western Balkans, but those countries that are already in the EU. Again, that's the customs union. The biggest trading partner of Turkey in the region is Romania, and then Bulgaria and Greece come after. The Western Balkans, and including the Muslim nations, or the Muslim majority nations in the Western Balkans, that you assume would be close to Turkey, bit of a footnote when it comes to economic relations. This point that Turkey is sometimes with the West, sometimes playing to his advantage, trying to Sunni Muslim card, investing in connections to regional elites, co-opting, and so on and so forth, playing independently. The last point about Turkey, and I realize it's a very superficial analysis, I beg to be forgiven, is that compared to 10, 15 years now, domestic politics plays a greater role in Turkish relations. There are two dimensions there. The government's fight with the Gulen network, the Cemaat or FETÖ as it's called in Turkey, has been external, not just in the Western Balkans, but also in the post-Soviet Africa and elsewhere, and in the Caucasus certainly. Back in the day, when Turkey was this zero problems policy, this was the advance guard of its influence. Now the Gulenists have become a liability, and a great part of Turkish agenda is just clamping down in trying to convince governments to join it in closing the Gulenist infrastructure or facilitating its transfer to organizations which are affiliated with the government, with the AKP. So it's defensive in that respect, and it's an instance of domestic politics spilling all the way into Turkish foreign relations. The other one is that in the competition for power, the Western Balkans have come into focus. If you remember the 2018 campaign and in presidential elections, one of the most well-attended, most high-profile rallies President had was staged in Sarajevo, because he was prevented from campaigning in Western Europe. So he chose the Bosnian capital as a running point for his supporters from Western Europe. It's just a shorter drive there, but also he could rally supporters from within the region. And it's very easy to have a rally in Sarajevo, because there is no Bosnian leader who, if given a call from Ankara, would say, no, you cannot have your rally here. And it's different in West. It was a signal both to diaspora voters, who make a difference, of course, when every vote counts, but also to domestic audiences, that Turkey is respected, it has friends, and has influence abroad. That'll be another instance where domestic politics kind of spill into external policies. So again, Turkey is there in the region, and it's likely to remain there by kind of virtue of geography and historical and social connection. But I don't think Turkey has necessarily a long-term agenda in terms of replacing or rolling back Western influence. So lastly, a few words about China, which is the big story now, not just because of COVID-19, also because of its economic a growing economic footprint. The region has seen a fair bit of it. I'm reminded of an interview the former EU Commissioner for Enlargement and Neighbourhood Policy, Johannes Hahn, gave to Financial Times, where he said, we underestimated China and overestimated Russia, in the sense that China has been playing this long-term game, bringing soft some investment as well, but also actually playing the time horizon much more in the future, and China is rising anyhow globally. So it's much more of a challenger than Russia, which opts in, but also then withdraws from the region on occasion. Certainly, China will be the big story, I think, in the next decade, partly because it's not just about the Western Balkans, but about the European periphery. If you think about the main Chinese initiative that grabs the headlines, the 17 plus one, which used to be 16 plus one, it brings together all the countries of post-communist Europe, plus now Greece, of course, in the same, which if you are a Balkan leader, this gives you prestige, recognition, treated as an outsider, but part of a club of countries together with Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Greece. So you're given status, which resonates domestically. Secondly, you money that then can be invested into projects that generate certainly corruption rent, but also project economic development plays again very well with voters. There are not many strings attached compared to European funding. And you can get political capital out of it. Now, of course, if you scratch the surface, you see that many of those loans, for instance, the thermal power plant built in Tuzla in Bosnia, or the built in Montenegro that brings hundreds of millions in investment, and people are saying that it creates this debt burden, debt trap for the Montenegrin budget, but also the high-speed railway connection between Belgrade and Budapest. Those are projects carried out by Chinese state enterprises. So, and at best, the region has subcontractors involved, but it's not money that goes directly into the local economy. Money transformed, recycled to China, and that applies to the Belt and Road Initiative. But it doesn't count, because what counts is the narrative, how Chinese interpret it through the media, and it's sold domestically. And let's say, but also elsewhere, government has direct or indirect control over worse weights of the media. Again, that's a function of this de-democratization process. You can look, they're coming, they're bringing money, they are not as arrogant as the Westerners, certainly not as Europeans, and they're helping. And it's me, your leader, that is taking care of economic development. Now, what's interesting also about China is that it doesn't have a political agenda, so it steers clear from the kind of political and security poison the region. China supports Serbia and Kosovo, but it's not very vocal. It hides behind Russia and elsewhere. It's not seeking a role in Bosnia and tries to focus on the economy. So that actually helps China develop relations with everyone in the Western Balkans. It's not really taking sides in local quarrels. And finally, to say about the Chinese is that the region might have some geostrategic importance for the Chinese, because if you assume that their long-term objective is to secure access to the European markets, the Western Balkans and also Greece, a corridor to those core markets. Eastern European nations, irrespective of inside the EU, outside, differ from Western Europeans because they mostly look towards Chinese investment. Their priority is not creating a playing field as a dirge for the Germans, even for Britain, so they can live with China, Chinese mercantilism, as it were, as it is, trying to leverage access for something in return. They're happy to receive the money without calling the Chinese. So for the Chinese, having Eastern Europe, including the Western Balkans on their side, co-opting it, might turn to be a very beneficial geopolitical strategy. So let's stop here. And lastly, a couple of sentences by way of summing up my argument. The Western Balkans is still a periphery of the West, but it's a very loose periphery. And the Western hegemony is weakening, and the balance of power is tipping towards local players, which have greater, they've expanded their autonomy. And over the long term, to balance, try to stick with, of course, the EU, work towards keeping access to the EU, but play on the side with all those external parties who also have their agendas. But I don't think they necessarily have a different geopolitical vision. They don't need to replace the West and their goals with the proviso that China might have a long-term strategy. But I don't think that either Turkey, Russia, or China right now sees itself as an alternative and is prepared to great losses or take risks in the Western Balkans. So thank you for your attention.